Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we'll have a quick intro like normal, then we're going to do a CP review with two guests, Sean, Thesaurus Rex, and Pipes from the board, Evan. And we're going to have a tip of the week, and then we are going to talk about why all men must die, and then finally have some closing comments.
All right, John, this is episode 4, but it's also our 99th episode. We are on the verge of our centennial. We feel old.
We are old, aren't we? 100's pretty old.
Well, we're not at 100 yet. We'll probably die before we reach 100. It's fine.
Okay.
So we're recording a little bit earlier this week. John has a tournament on Sunday. Normally we do a sort of wrap-up of some of the tournaments of the weekend, but many of them are just currently underway, including Thrones War. We're getting some pretty surprising results out of, but we can't really talk about how it ends. We don't know how it ends.
It'll be a surprise for the listeners if they haven't already looked it up by the time this airs.
Which they should have. So yeah. It'll be a surprise. It'll be a surprise for the listeners who weren't paying attention, and then we'll find out a week and a half later not having cared. Which, you know, this is not working for us. So you've obviously done some prep for your tournaments. We should go over, there's one point I wanted to mention last week that we didn't mention, and that's that the deck that we built in episode 2 with Dan Struhol, basically that deck with, I think, one plot change, a Here to Serve was removed, and Naval Superiority was put back in, and possibly one or two card changes, topped Swiss at a 30-person tournament. So Dan took that deck that with a few, you know, that he'd been working on for a while and that we built on the cast and tweaked and did really well with it. And I think I've had a lot of luck with that deck as well in my game nights. I've actually been using it as a teaching deck for how to handle really aggressive decks, and it's been working well for that. So I am extremely pleased that, you know, what we put out there then got field tested so quickly.
And is doing well, which is great.
One thing that we have been seeing, surprisingly, even in these preliminary results, is a resurgence of Night's Watch Kraken, or a surgence of Night's Watch Kraken, which I think dates back to Jeremy Hammond's store championship win, after which Dennis took a very, very similar deck. But I think Jeremy Hammond deserves the credit for putting that on people's radar.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's a great build. I remember the first time I actually saw the deck, Jeremy was playing it against me and Glazer on our YouTube channel. And it was an interesting match. And I said to Glazer afterwards, I said, I think in general, it's a very strong deck right now and people have to be ready for it. And it's mostly a change in mindset and play style, I think, that allows you to do better against it. But it's not an easy one to make.
There was some news this week. We managed to post some spoilers that were posted from Game Trader magazine, thanks to Scott Awesome on the Facebook group, a picture of Braun with no text, and a Raider from Pike. I have a feeling that maybe we might be entering the era where all the Greyjoy characters are Raiders from Orcmont, Orcwood, Reaver, Ravager, Raider, and we'll be just as confused as we were in first edition. But this is the one that gives ambush to
weapons,
which is a neat mechanic. It's a neat thing for a non-unique character to do and add to your deck, because you can get it a little more reliably than a unique character. Is it good?
Now you can set up weapons. Hey, being able to have ambush and an axe will be pretty good.
Yeah, I think it will. Yeah. But I think what most people noticed is that in that card art, I'm pretty sure that Raider from Pike is got his sword stabbed right in.
Sweet.
Other more official sources of spoilers. Actually, it's kind of confusing. We've actually reviewed the chapter pack. We had access to all the cards just a few days ago when we recorded that. Turns out that some people that have ordered through Amazon have gotten all the cards as well now.
Yep.
So we're not actually spoiling anything when we talk about it in the upcoming segment, but no big deal that way either. It is weird that Amazon broke street date. I don't know who the seller within there is, but I'm sure that this is part of those kinks that they're working out in the early days. FFG did post a bunch of spoilers.
Yes. Little article to go with them, as always.
Anything that really jumped out at you for these spoilers?
Well, now I have to go to the article again.
Yeah.
I liked some of the interactions we're seeing with Stark. I really like the idea of the pack survives. A lot of people have been talking about it as if, you know, that Direwolf card is needed, but you can kneel two Stark characters to cancel that effect too. And with the stand that we're seeing, like with Jon Snow or Rob from the core set, you know, kneeling Stark characters might not be all that bad.
Yeah, I really like the idea behind this sacrifice mechanic. I'm not sure if it pays off, but it's a sort of, what's the term I'm looking for? Not really an addiction, maybe an addiction.
Yeah, it's
like when you play, you sacrifice some chud and you get the stand and you push the bigger challenge and it's good, but there's a cost every single time. Your board is getting smaller and smaller, and it's
right.
costing.
And the only way you can win that next challenge is to sacrifice another chud.
Exactly.
You just have to do another
chasing
line.
Chasing the dragon. That's what they call it, right? Chasing the dragon. I don't even know why I know that. Anyway.
Oh, I know why you know that, Alex.
All right. And, so I do think that these kind of make it tempo sacrifice for a tempo gain are inherently very interesting mechanics. Whether it's feasible, like, that Jon Snow looks like it's feasible. A card like that looks like it will work. And I also think the Pack Survives will work. Needle, maybe slightly less, although I think that the fact that it gives that +2 strength might be enough to keep it around and useful. So,
well, it also stops
potential.
The character from going away, right? It goes back to your hand.
Yeah, but you're spending a card to get the card back to your hand. I mean, sometimes the character...
But it has an effect during the time, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I am really intrigued by this, by developing the sacrifice theme, and I enjoyed
the
article.
Character has a come into play effect, it's fancy.
That's
so
true.
We haven't seen any of those from
yet. We haven't
Stark
seen those. No. I also noticed that we're getting some 4 or 5 costers there that may well help with the sort of first Snow of Winter syndrome we expect to see, which is kind of neat as well. I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on this box now.
I'm not sure this whole Arianne Stark where you're paying 4 gold and sacking her to kill a strength 3 character, but...
Yeah. I really like the core version because she can take ice and has stealth, so... I guess currently I'm leading elsewhere, but we've seen a similar version of that area in the first edition.
And right? She didn't really see play.
Ah, she did. She saw some play.
Some.
Other Thrones-related news. This isn't necessarily Thrones-related, but I have been reading Knight of the Realm. Have you read that yet?
No.
That's Martin's compilation of the Hedge Knight and Sworn Sword and Mystery Knight. Basically the prequel... Stories of Sir Dunk the Tall?
Well, you see, I've never read any of his other work, so...
Okay, but this is still set in Westeros, and it's the same thing. They're just these short little stories. And I'd read them before in graphic novel format. I thought that was the original format they'd been released in, and I'd read the first two that way, but now I'm reading them in just text form. And the graphic novels were surprisingly... They covered everything, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend that someone go and read them if they have already seen the graphic novels. But I still haven't read Mystery Knight, so I'm looking forward to that. But it's been fun to dip back into Martin. He made his way up my reading list gradually and slowly as I read through fewer things and do it in shorter time periods. But anyway, I'd recommend anyone who is waiting for the next books and hasn't checked out these that at least... I think they're decent enough stories in and of themselves, although not stellar and not fantastically written. But if you have the wider context of the Song of Ice and Fire books so far, then that adds something, because you're digging into the history a little bit. You sort of know what to expect of a Targaryen and know what to expect of some of these houses by reputation. So I've enjoyed it so far.
Awesome.
So you will not yet be able to report to us on your... great victory / crushing defeat tomorrow with Greyjoy?
Correct. We have no idea how poorly or how well I will do, since it's the future.
It's the future. And if you do really poorly, we probably won't mention it in our 100th episode.
Exactly.
And if you do really well, we probably won't mention it either because it's our 100th episode and we have more important things to talk about.
This is true. Should we talk about the prize we're going to give out and the competition?
I don't know. Do you think we should do that on the 100th episode? Or do you think we should talk about it now?
I think we should give listeners a heads up. Now,
but we kind of have to spoil some of the content of the episode if we do it. No, I think we'll just leave it for next week.
All right.
But we'll leave this bit in to tease them about it.
Sounds good.
All right. So we are doing our second ever chapter pack review with the new format. And as usual, we're joined by two guests. John, why don't you introduce one of the guests?
Sure. We have an FFG employee here. That's not the one Alex wanted, you see.
I wanted to introduce Evan.
Evan Johnson. He's Pipes on the Board.
Hello.
He is joining us today for the perspective of a Shaga player. And what do you do at FFG, just so the viewers know? Because I guess some of them will know Pipes, but they won't know you. And you do a lot more than your persona online.
Yes. So my job description is marketing coordinator, which basically means that I write a lot of things. I write a good portion of the articles that go up on the website, including pretty much everything for Game of Thrones, as well as many other games. I also write various ads for online and various trade magazines, and I moderate a lot of forums, and including Card Game DB.
Now, just to be clear, Evan's not joining us from the perspective of an FFG employee today.
He's not at all.
A player in his own right. You won the Harrenhal tournament at the FFG headquarters. You just recently placed, top four? Was that a store championship in the last, 2 weeks, right?
Yeah, there were, 20 people there. And, I made top four.
And you actually won the Harrenhal tournament with Stark, right?
Yeah, it was Stark Banner of the Stag.
I like that.
Yeah.
Took me so a while to warm up to Stark. But, yes. But I'm really warming up.
And then we also have Sean from the Ottawa meta. He is here to join us from the...
Way to make him sound like an also-ran.
Whoa, but I'm not done.
Okay. Well, I am less than Pipes, though, to be fair.
But Sean was nice enough to do the alternate art cards that you see show up sometimes for us. So he's the mastermind behind the formatting and layout, and he's helped the New York Meta and a bunch of other people. You can actually see his name on the bottom of those cards now. But he is also here to talk about the Knight, as in the Greyjoy Knight, because he's a Greyjoy player. So he'll be looking at these cards from the Knight's perspective.
All of Greyjoy's first edition Knights, which is your favorite Greyjoy Knight, Sean?
It's really hard to say. There's so many Grey Knights to choose from, but I think the Knight is actually one of the greatest characters in Greyjoy's... I don't even know the
stable of knights.
Stable. Arsenal. Army of knights.
The army.
I feel like it actually was kind of a missed opportunity to include him in this pack because his fellow Harla, the reader, was in the pack before, and this pack is all about knights. So why wouldn't you have the reader and then the knight and then actually have a good card for the knight who doesn't just remove a card from the top of the deck?
So I will move seamlessly from you talking about the knight to mentioning that one of the reasons the knight is the greatest character, he's the one that stands in front of a castle, calls out people, fights them one by one, and keeps doing it until they eventually surrender. And that should be the hint that I am going to be taking the perspective of a Nedley player today and bring the perspective of the books to these cards. I feel it's a very Nedley chapter pack. And John, what do you have for us?
I'm going to be looking at this pack from the Thoros of Myr perspective, which is basically the King of Melee. And the reason I wanted to do that is because there's some very powerful Jamie Melee cards in here, if you're a Jamie Melee player. Do those exist? Has anyone ever
met? Of course they do.
All right. Well, they'll enjoy my perspective then.
All right. So it is worth noting that the chapter pack is not out in stores yet. It'll be out on the 25th, or at least in Canada on the 25th. 19 out of the 20 cards have been spoiled. I happen to have my hands on the chapter pack through entirely legitimate means. See, the fact that Evan is on this cast and not saying anything against it means it's entirely true. So we're actually going to go review this. We have the go-ahead. So I don't know if this extra card that has been unspoiled will come up or not. If it doesn't, we're not going to go ahead and spoil it. You'll find it out on Thursday. If it does, then it does. So, I guess...
Trigger warning.
Who's going to start us off? How about John? You started off last week. Start again.
Sure. Now, this might be a card that we're going to see in some of the other people's...
I think that might be a general trend this week. I have a feeling we're going to have a lot of overlap.
Yeah, choices. But I'm going to be talking about the Tourney for the King. This is a plot. It's 381. This is each knight character you control gains renown and immune to opponent's events. Well, if there's nothing that you want to do more in Melee is to burst power grab, and having a bunch of little knights all of a sudden all gain renown is very useful. Add on top of that that it has this great 8 initiative that might let you cement your first player to win the game quickly, or at least control who's going to go first. I think there's a lot of value in that plot in Melee.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the best plots that we've seen so far, honestly. Question for you, John. What is the best house to run a Tourney for the King?
The best house? That's really tough. A lot of the houses have, we have Tumblestone Knights from Stark. We have the Dane Knights from Martell. We have Baratheon, who has the little knights that take away a power.
Yeah.
And actually, because of the Vanguard Lancer, the ability to take that power away is so powerful in Melee. If I had to say, what's the best house for this to run out of Melee, that knight is probably more useful for Melee games. So I'm going to say Baratheon.
Yeah.
The Arbor Knights are also so good as well. It is tough. Now, I do want to say that this one's really interesting to me as a plot because it's such a great Melee plot. And up to date, in my experience in Melee, there's been a huge Greyjoy presence, and it's one of the factions that's least equipped to take advantage of this plot. So I really see this as almost equalizing the Melee environment by giving other people an 8 initiative plot that's a good closer, like Rise of the Kraken.
Mm-hmm. I have to agree. I think this is one of the best ways that they could balance out the plot disparity that Greyjoy has, because it doesn't have a Melee disparity yet. I think Tyrell is still a pretty big force in Melee in the current environment.
Outside of Greyjoy, I think the only question for a Tourney for the King is, do you run one or do you run two? Because it's not restricted, right?
It is not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's really bomb. It's kind of like it has the effect of Clash of Kings where, I win a challenge and I get power. Being able to have a bunch of chuds and some of the cards that we're going to mention later now bringing more chuds that have the right trait. It just, big impact, big swings. I defend challenges, I get power. That's how you close games.
Did anyone else have this on their list?
Yes.
Ah, well, tell us why it was on your list, the knight.
I think as the knight, a Tourney for the King is very appropriate. And it also just kind of reinforced the knight trait. I think the knight is valued for being a knight in Greyjoy. It also gives him that immunity from put to the sword and tears, confinement, Kraken's grasp. If he were to exist, I imagine he'd be at risk for all of those things. the high initiative also helps to go first, competes with Rise, as we mentioned before, competes with most everything except for, I think, Sneak Attack and Clash. The lower gold is the only place where I would kind of leave it at a one of, unless you're maybe running it out of Tyrell Lannister, in which case you can probably afford the gold drop. And I think Tyrell's the best house for it because they have, 7 knights when the next pack comes out with Horror and Slobber?
Yeah.
Because they'll have 3 Arbor Knights, Knight of Flowers, and then those two if you're just running one of them. But, of course, you're running more
Knight of Flowers. Knight of Flowers already has renown.
But the immune to events matters.
Yeah, the immunity plus a fortified position. How does it react there?
And you can throw in the Hedge Knights as well.
Yeah, and the Hedge Knights, bringing you to, a ridiculous amount of knights and now confirming 15. You'll get it. Yeah.
All right, so that's one card for John, one card for Sean. Evan, do you want to give us a Shaga card then?
Sure, yeah. I don't know how many of these cards are necessarily Shaga per se. They're more than just the cards that I really find interesting or inventive, but we'll call them Shaga and go with that. We could call them Evan cards,
You could choose one of the builders on the wall, Evan, and, they design and build interesting things.
Okay, defenses. There we go. This is the Halder perspective.
Oh, you really want to be associated with that art?
Okay. The first Halder card is the Lord of the Crossing, the new agenda that we get in this. It's a neutral agenda. It has the House Frey trait, which I'm sure will become important at some point. That was sarcasm. During the first challenge, you initiate each phase. Each of your participating characters gets -1 strength. During the third challenge, you initiate each phase. Each of your participating characters gets +2 strength. If you win this challenge, gain 1 power for your faction. So what I really like about this card is that it is something that we have never seen before, to my knowledge, in Game of Thrones. It is I really like the direction that it pushes people that you have to build around this. You're not just going to slot this into your fealty deck or to your no agenda deck. This is something that you have to very specifically build around. And I think that it can actually be reasonably competitive. I guess I'm a Shag at heart, but I do have quite a fair Jamie side. So, yeah, I'm definitely going to be running this at Historic Championship.
I wonder if this means that we're going to get a new Walter Frey, and if the text will be as confusing as the first one.
If he can accidentally kill himself with Deadly? Yes. I mean, this card, it narrowly avoided my Nedley list because I really feel like it's sort of that showing up late and winning more while not committing early that we associate mm-hmm. with Walder Frey. But the art is phenomenal. I'm so excited to see what people will do with this, with it auto-standing Randall, with it mm-hmm. pushing your Red Viper challenge up to insane amounts of strength because it's +2 per character, mm-hmm. with it allowing you to use that Melisandre in a challenge against Targ because she's now 6 strength instead of, you know. So there's a lot of room for it. Mm-hmm. But perhaps the thing that I'm most excited about is how this will affect faction breakdown. Because right now the only reason to choose a faction as its main faction is the loyal cards. Yeah. Either through fealty or because you're going to use it as a main faction and another faction will be the banner. So because Martell has a lot of good banner cards, you see it more often as a banner of the sun, even if it's 60 or 70% of the deck. This is the first agenda where you'll have to play all Martell, but you won't be doing it with any regards to loyalty. Yep. And so I think you'll see a lot more Tyrell and a lot more Martell rise in popularity just because of the way they were such good banner factions, but the only way to play them with the agenda is as a main faction. And I'm interested to see how that shakes out.
And that extra power gain is not something to laugh at. Like, being able to successfully get an extra power every turn can mean a lot. So I think people shouldn't overlook that. Like, even Lannister, we get a lot of value from this agenda because they're so slow at gaining power generally. They kind of plod along if you run just like, you know, fealty Lannister and you end up going 5-6 plots. This will reduce your overall plots by 1 or maybe 2, and that can make a big difference in a game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of my favorite things about this agenda is the way that it works so well with the Bone Way, another card in this pack. You know, you make your first challenge, all your characters on -1 strength. Your opponent could easily win if they want to, but if they do, then you'll get a Bone Way counter or whatever other losing a challenge tricks.
Or, yeah, long
Martell
plan.
Has.
Or, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, admittedly, the Bone Way is not the best lose a challenge trick that Martell has up their sleeve.
Well, I mean, in the same vein, I really like it with things like Arbor Knight. You launch the Arbor Knight with Baron Heat, which we'll talk about later. I'm sure it's on someone's list. And it's a 0-strength character. Anything they block with, you can remove from the challenge. And then you can pump them up a strength or two and win the challenge. It's just it's so fun.
Cheeky monkey.
So did the agenda make anyone else's list?
Nope.
Then I'm so glad it was on Evans, because there were so many things I was eager to say about it. So I'll move on to Nedley and bring the one card that I can be fairly sure isn't on one of the other lists, even though I think it's a great card. But I really like it from a Nedley standpoint, and this is Moon Boy. Now, it's a fun piece of art. It's a fun little card. It's a 2-cost character with a power icon, 2 strengths, and he's a fool. And he has insight, but he has the forced reaction that is sort of an opposite of insight, where if you lose a challenge in which he's participating, you discard a card at random from your hand. And I think Moon Boy is supposed to be this pie-faced simpleton. The quote even says it. And yet he's got these incisive remarks, these insightful remarks, these very cutting remarks at everybody at the party, for instance. And so you have to wonder whether he's really an idiot at all. But, you know, it goes every way. Everybody gets insulted. And to me, I feel like fools was a trait that was thrown around occasionally in first edition, and it never had some sort of narrative. We've already seen Moon Boy, and I think Patchface for, Butterbumps for
Butterbumps,
Martell,
yeah.
And for Tyrell. And I really think that's an exceptionally Nedley way to do it, to make them insightful, but that they can backfire with reverse insight. So I can't wait till we see everybody's favorite fools in the game, right? All the other fools.
We've already seen Theon.
So Patchface?
So Patchface. All right, John, want to give us a second Thoros card?
Absolutely. So my next Thoros card is a Targaryen card. It's an attachment, and it's the Silver Steed. This reads, Dothraki characters are Daenerys Targaryen only. While attached characters participating in a power challenge, it gains renown. Renown? good in melee, good for power grab, but it's really the reaction I like. After attached character gains power using renown, sacrifice the silver steed. You may initiate an additional power challenge this phase. Like, before we came on the cast, Alex, you were actually telling me about a melee game you had just played at your local game store, and you had described this perfect world where you got two power challenges off with two claim and racked up like 8 power in a single...
no renown, too. Yeah, I went from 2 to 10 power.
and you did that through, you know, being able to pump your claim with Sun Spear, and you had an extra challenge because your plot, etc. But
the title.
Yeah. So could you just imagine being able to do that just with a simple attachment? This card will really bring back like the old dragon style melee decks of Targaryen, but at the same time, because it's attachment, you know, there's going to be some control. But I think currently, at least I haven't played as many melee games as I would have liked, but the meta doesn't seem to have a lot of attachment control right now, so I think this is going to shine in that type of meta.
My first instinct on seeing this card is that I don't think we've ever seen first-person art in the game before.
Mm-hmm.
And this of Dany riding Silver Steed is really striking. I don't know if we've seen a whole bunch of art by this artist, Smirtui, but it's certainly a risky way to approach it differently, and I think it really pays off. Mm-hmm. But I think you're right in labeling this a melee card and not a joust card right now, mostly because there are Dothraki characters that are no attachments except weapon. There are Dothraki characters that already have renown, and Dany has other ways of getting renown right now. So the conditional renown just isn't there, even though one cost for conditional renown would be great in joust as well. There just aren't the targets for it. But that reaction is mm-hmm. definitely driver for melee.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the first-person perspective of the art. The attachment frame kind of works for that. It looks like you're looking through the eye almost of Dany because it's this oval shape.
Yeah, I always wonder how much the artists know about the templating of the cards and how influenced they are by that.
Mm-hmm.
But this looks like the kind of thing you can do that you couldn't do if you didn't know.
We would have to get one or two on the cast here sometime.
I know, I'm trying.
Well, as somebody who does it on an amateur level, it's very helpful when you know the template.
Okay, you call
when
it,
you're trying to.
Oh, I thought you were saying art on an amateur level. You just meant the template for the cards.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm not actually doing the art. Thank you, John, for reminding everyone. I am a boundless hack.
That's not true. I saw you in some kind of magazine or something with your 3D modeling.
Oh, true. Thank you. Yeah. Ottawa Business Journal.
Yeah.
They listed me as the wrong name.
Yep, that was you. But your picture was there. So I knew it was you. They really did. Who did they say you were?
It's a coworker. I wouldn't want to say her name. But
they thought you were a she.
It was pretty good. They're like, this guy has great 3D art, and then gave him a girl's name.
A Chinese girl's name, so it's clearly not me.
Okay.
In so many levels. All right.
You're up next, John.
Okay. From one horse to another, I've got the Mare in Heat. This is a war horse for Tyrell, and it's a knight character only, but now we have so many knight targets, that's not really much of a hindrance if you're building around this. And it reads, one attached character is attacking or defending alone. Mare in Heat gains action, kneel Mare in Heat to choose a participating character with strength higher than that of attached character and remove that character from the challenge. I mean, what do I need to say about the knight's perspective? There's a mare. I mean, you need a horse to ride into battle, right? And we all know the Knight of Flowers' famous trick with the Mare in Heat to distract the other horse.
Hey, this is my Nedley territory you're trotting on.
I think the knight is pretty Nedley. And, I mean, I think it's pretty great from working from attacking or defending. So you can throw off a more powerful defender. You can synergize with Lady Sansa's Rose. There's a lot of ways this can pay off.
You play jousting contest, and you're basically guaranteed to win a challenge, right?
Like, absolutely.
They can either get their guy removed or let you win. So either way, you're winning.
and then they think, aha, I'll put in my character with lower strength so I defend it. Oh, Marge just made you +3, and now you lose anyways.
And by 5 or more.
By 5 or more, yeah.
Yeah.
My favorite, this is a very stupid combo, but it's one of my favorites that you can do with this pack, is to take Balon Greyjoy and give him knighted, which gives him +1 strength in the knight trait, and then give him the Mare in Heat, and then just did nothing can defend.
That's right.
You have no options.
Has that card been spoiled? the knighted?
It has not, but I have it in hand, so it's fine. I just didn't know if it would come up. So yeah, that's the neutral attachment. I think this card made my Nedley pick. For those of you not familiar with the scene in question, the Marin Heat jousting contest, we've already established that in the game there are these 1v1 contests, the plot and Loras, the Knight of Flowers, that they involve power, like Sansa's Rose and Loras as well. So in the semifinals of the Tourney for the Hand, there's the Gregor Clegane is riding this foul-tempered stallion, and the Knight of Flowers decides that he's going to ride this Marin Heat that drives that stallion crazy. And basically, despite the fact that Gregor is enormous and unstoppable, his horse basically throws him off because he's gone wild at this mare, and so Loras wins by default. And that's exactly what this card is doing, in every sense of the word. Like, Gregor has higher strength than Loras, fit. The challenge is basically nullified, the character's pulled out of it, fit. You know, I just think it's during a joust, attacking or defending alone, it fits. In every way, this is just such a Nedley card, as well as being a really, really fun card to play with.
What do you think the odds of the situation actually happening where a defending Tyrell player uses Loras to remove Gregor from a challenge with the Marin Heat? That would just, like, trigger all of my, like, my Nedley-gasms all at once.
Exactly, a Ned-gasm.
Well, the fun thing about it is that no matter who the Marin Heat is on, you can always remove Sir Gregor.
Yep. The occasional Tywin if you, you know.
Okay, yeah.
On a
okay,
calling the banner's
fair.
Turn, maybe.
Yeah.
I just don't see Tywin riding a mare. It doesn't quite fit. Like, anyway.
He's a stallion man.
Did anyone else have the Marin Heat?
No. So I did. So I had it as a Nedley, but so we're on to Evan then.
All right. Well, the next card that I find interesting, the next Halder card, is the Baratheon plot. It is the King's Peace. It is 4 gold, 0 initiative, 1 claim, 5 reserve, plot deck limit 1. It's an edict and a scheme. And it says, reaction, after a military or power challenge is initiated against you, the attacking player may either sell his or her that faction card to yours. If that player does not, the challenge immediately ends with no winner and or loser. And this is a plot that I'm not really sure if I'm going to run. I'm still not decided as to whether or not I think it's any good, but I love the idea of finding your opponent their limited response, basically, or making them give you power. But I feel like that could create some really interesting, really tough choices, especially as the game goes on and we get more and more quote-unquote limited response, kneel your faction card effects. And I'm very, very interested to see where that goes.
I think that what hurts this plot the most is that 5 reserve.
Yeah.
Because there is something about using this as an opener and ensuring that you can't fall too far behind early on because they don't have the power to give you and they need that economy early on. But you just can't use a 5 reserve plot with 4 gold as an opener, you know, unless it's marched to the wall. And so you're using it later on and someone giving you power is good. It's tough to tell whether it'll work out, but I agree, mm-hmm. It's pretty interesting.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it may even have made someone else's list. No? John, did it make your list? No? Okay.
Nope.
I figured it. In Melee, it's got a different dynamic to it by adding an additional cost to doing challenges against you that serves as a greater deterrent, especially when power is involved.
Yes.
For sure. But I think there's better Melee cards still.
That's probably true.
All right. Well, give us a better Melee card since I already gave away a second Nedley card, the Marin Heat.
All right. Well, we talked about this card, and you guys are all going to laugh at me because you said, you know, there's better ways for Martell to lose. But in Melee...
Good.
But in Melee, when you actually have 3 players to lose to, you have mm-hmm. 3 times the opportunity to lose challenges. And there's no limit on that reaction. You can be losing challenges all over the place. And the fact that it's a dominant action to kneel, the Boneway actually provides a safe place to hold that power. Mm-hmm. And a 3-power jump is really is nice in Melee. And it's a dominance jump. So I think that the Boneway is actually a good Melee card. Now, I don't think it's a Jamie Melee card like the other two I talked about. I just think it's so much more useful in Melee because it's completely useless in Joust.
Isn't there a Night's Watch character who can restand locations? So you could restand them and then tap it multiple times after you've built it up?
Exactly. So you could actually possibly get 6 power from this. And because in Melee there's all the redirects and stuff, you could just start like getting people to throw their challenges at you just because you can lose. You're like, I don't have a hand. Like, keep taking these intrigue on me. I don't care. and just build up those tokens.
I think that's part of the use of it in Melee. I think the other part of the use of it is that people will hesitate. Exactly. Yeah. Even
you get
though
5 tokens, they'll be like,
yeah.
I don't want to put the last token that gets them 3 power on there.
They feel like that one challenge is giving you 3 power, which is rubbish. But they feel like it is, and if that saves you from losing a challenge and saves a card or a power, then that too is useful. So I can see that. Yeah, I can see that.
Until the newly made Lord comes out and crushes your hopes and dreams. takes all 12 boner tokens off, and it's just over.
Good thing that is.
12 boner. Oh, the Greyjoy player has to bring up the newly made Lord. You know, he's not a knight.
Missed opportunity.
All right, Sean. There's got to still be a knight in here somewhere.
There's one more knight in this pack of knights, the Hedge Knight in particular. I think the knight appreciates a Hedge Knight because, I mean, we all need our little peon knights, right? Our little chuddy knights. I think much like the Stormtrooper army, like the Hedge Knights are the fodder, right? They're like the guys who sleep under the hedges, literally, and they come and they fight your wars. And I think they kind of open a new era of efficiency characters. I'll actually describe what the character is for those who don't have the card in front of them. It's a 2-cost character. It's neutral. Only has a military icon. It's 2 strength, and it has the knight trait. But while you control another knight, the Hedge Knight gains 1 strength and a power icon. So with that really, really easy trigger, especially out of Tyrell, who, as we explained earlier, probably has like 15 knights in their deck, you can have a 3-strength bicon character for the cost of 2. And that just makes me so happy. Kind of reminds me of the Drowned Man way back when. Dan Pierce Drowned, I think it was, from 1E, where he was a cheap chuddy, but he gets stronger when you had more locations. I mean, with the Horus and Hobber coming out and the Arbor Knights and Knight of Flowers, I think this is a natural fit in Tyrell.
He's going to be a great character in those decks that have heavy knight presence. Like you said, he's just so efficient. Like, even if you're not running an overall knight theme, if you have around 6 to 7 other knights just in there because they're good, like, you're going to run a couple Knight of the Flowers regardless. You're probably going to run Arbor Knights regardless in Tyrell. He'll just slot into this great efficiency slot. I think you're totally right. Very Jamie card.
And this is the 3rd out of 4 Thomas Jedrzyk art cards that we've named so far. He's done 4 in this chapter pack, and we've named 3. Let's see if we can finish that streak. I will say that I wonder if the 2 gold on a neutral card is quite the same as 2 gold on a non-neutral.
That's a good point, because you can't reduce it with a faction reducer.
So I do think 2 for 3, it is efficient, and when you're using gold, there's no difference. But as being a neutral, it's cheating a little bit to call him as efficient as a 2 for 3 would be in any other faction.
True, and you're not going to pop a King's Road for him.
No, certainly not. Well, but if you're desperate.
I think that difference is, you know, there's definitely a difference there, but it's not huge.
No.
And the one cool thing about him, he's one of those cards where the more you put him in your deck, the more efficient he gets, because he'll trigger off himself. Mm-hmm. If you have 2 of him on the board, all of a sudden they're like shaking hands. They're making each other stronger.
Yeah, so he won't trigger off himself, but he'll trigger off his friends.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I mean his own version of card. By the way, I like to refer to him as the hedge horse, because it looks like the horse is the main character. It looks very much in frame, and he looks really happy.
He does, now that you've mentioned it.
And you're only going to see the horse now whenever you look at the card and smile.
Wonderful.
That was a gift from Sean to our listeners.
Nice. So, Evan.
All right. So my last pick for the hauler cards of the pack, I'm torn between 2, and I'll tell you what they are, and you can see that they're basically kind of the same thing. So the first one is the 4th of the Tomas Jedrzejczyk cards, which is Attainted. It is a Martell attachment, 1 cost, opponent's character only, attached character loses an intrigue icon. And the other one is for Greyjoy. It is the Fishing Net, 1 cost, condition item weapon, opponent's character only, attached character cannot be declared as a defender. And what I love about these is the new design space that is getting pushed with negative attachments that are non-terminal, the kind of attachment that you can throw on your opponent's characters and they can kill those characters and it just comes right back to your hand so you can use it over and over again. And that kind of recursion, pseudo-recursion, is very cool. Cannot wait to make a deck that just puts as many of those in as I can and make life miserable for my opponents.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be a strong Greyjoy Martell kind of deck. And I think the fishing net, throwing that on Eddard or catching left and right, and it's like a character it's designed to defend, it's just the greatest feeling in the world.
It's worth noting that both of these are conditions. There clearly seems to be some thought in like, these are going to keep hitting you unless you have attachment hate. Which is something like you need to start thinking about.
Maester.
Well, exactly, and so I'm glad to see that, too, in that you could imagine, we just had Nate last week, and he told us that Valor was coming back. These things, you know, you wipe the board, and then you have tools already for the next
eight of them in your hand.
You know, that's pretty impressive. There has to be this drive towards attachment hate, and we're seeing that. Lots of people are running attachment hate now, but I think cards like these will keep that a force long-term of the meta. I'm very excited about the design space they're exploring. But we'll pretend you said only Attainted just so that we've hit all four of Thomas Jedrzejczyk's cards.
That's fair.
I like the art on Attainted, too.
All right,
I think Attainted is one of the more valuable icon removal attachments you can have, too, right? With taking away an intrigue icon, now you can tears them. Hey, yep. Tywin, I hear you like your tears.
And then Attainted back in your hand.
And then Attainted comes back, exactly. It's reusable. It's the two-card combo.
Yep.
All right, so my very last Nedley card, and this card is the reason that I wanted to be the Ned guy for this pack, and I'm surprised that it hasn't come up yet. I thought it was going to... And that's Sir Gregor Clegane. Now, we can start off with just, he's 7 cost, he is 10 strength, and he only has a military icon. Gregor in the books is 8 feet tall, he wields a two-handed sword in one hand, he's basically invincible, he wears plate that nobody else could lift, let alone fight in.
And he's not super smart.
And he's not super smart, sure, or at least very angry most of the time. But he is this monster, and being the highest strength character in the game, being higher strength than the Red Viper, you know, this is kind of important. I won't tell anyone why. higher strength than Loras, we mentioned.
You can look it up on YouTube, though.
Indeed. I think that's already starting to show that there's some neat fit in there. But there's so much more behind this card. I think I may be going too far into it, in that I don't think any of this was planned. But, for instance, if Sir Gregor Clegane and Loras were opposed in a challenge, Sir Gregor would be able to use Put to the Sword, which is exactly what happens in the jousting contest. He gets flipped over, then he decides to attack him, and he's going to put Loras to the sword. So who jumps into the challenge? The 6 strength Hound. 6 is exactly enough to prevent a Put to the Sword from Gregor. How is that not amazing?
I know. Yeah, you're reading a little too into that. He's got pillage, though, and he's known for going around and burning stuff down. I'll give you that.
I mean, he's Tywin's monster. Tywin just lets him loose in the Riverlands. He doesn't know what he's going to go do. He just knows he's going to wreak havoc. And that's what the pillage is, and that's what the ability is. He's deadly. He's dangerous. Something's going to die. I think there's a specific quote in the book about him, you know, punching someone's face in and they just die, or killing someone because they snored too loudly. Like, to me, that's the kind of thing that you're seeing in this ability. The only point against him is that in the books he is not a lord. And so it is a bit weird to have that lord trait. But there's so much about this card that is Nedley. The art is fantastic. I
like that you mentioned the art. The art is also one of my favorite parts about this card. And honestly, my favorite part of the art is those tiny little braids that Gregor has along the back of his head.
Someone called them the Padawan braids.
I can just imagine, like, that hairdo would look ridiculous, and I love that this huge, imposing monster of a man would have the most laughable haircut.
Actually, they're dreadlocks.
That again brings me on to even more Nedliness, because I can't stop. this guy's the character hits the board, and even though the odds of him hitting your 7 cost character or any of that are extremely low, the character makes you afraid. Every time you're going to trigger that reaction and you're going to pillage that card, you're going to be afraid. And this is probably the scariest man in Westeros to see a in person, like not to know is out to get you, but to see in person. Mm-hmm. And again, there's that, you know, regardless of how legitimate it is, you will be afraid every time you turn over a card for his pillage.
Yeah, I love that Lannister has kind of established an identity, and that identity is growing as the house of monsters, if you will. You know, you have your Gregor Clegane and the Tickler, and I'm sure further down we're going to see Qyburn and some more of Gregor's, you know, band of pillagers and rapists and just all of those creepy, terrible people. And it's great.
The creepy, terrible people. That describes most Lannister players I know.
Both the Tickler and Gregor have this kind of random ability, this gamble or the dice rolling ability that we had talked about with Nate before. So I'm definitely seeing that Lannister theme emerge more and more as the packs come out, which is great.
There's something else funny about the art. It was suggested on a Facebook post that the people were actually next to him for scale.
But and he's twice as tall.
I'd like to take that a step forward and say that the entire village back there is actually next to him for scale. And he's just a true monster.
All right. Well, I am extremely excited to start playing with this pack. Even with these cards, the Nedley cards and so on, to me the real force is this is the first time we get to see the injection of a new agenda. And it'll be hard to predict what that does to the meta, what that does making mono-faction decks and therefore plays with everybody's curve, because we're not at the point where the curves look the same in Banner and mono-faction. So I think just from a technical standpoint, I'm really interested to see how this plays out. But it's also probably the chapter pack with the most coherent theme to it that we've seen so far. Like, there is so much of that knight aspect in it.
There is a lot of knights. And so much of the Nedliness.
Yeah, exactly. Even so much of the Nedliness is tied to the jousting contests and the plot and the story of the tournament, that it may be the Nedliest chapter pack we've seen since, like, the Kingsguard back in first edition.
Hmm. Yeah.
Or at least the most coherent as a theme.
Yeah.
All right. So, quick parting shots. What's the first deck you're building coming out of here, John?
I'm going to build a Tyrell Lord of the Crossing Knights deck.
Sean?
I was going to say the same thing, but he stole it, so now I got to change my answer. Probably Greyjoy, because I'm a hardcore Greyjoy player. I don't know. I want to get knighted in there since it's been spoiled now, and I want to throw it on Balin as many times as I can, because it's an innate boost just by itself, plus one. And then when you have those little hedgling knights in there, they're going to benefit from that. Maybe I'll like shoehorn in the mare and heat for fun. We'll see.
Yeah, go for it.
Just make Balin as ridiculous as possible as mine.
It's a tier one combo right there.
It's a combo.
We didn't say good deck. We said deck.
You're going to build, exactly. Yeah. And Evan?
I am also going to build the Knight's deck, but I'm actually going to take it a Stark Banner of the Rose to get the Tumblestone Knight, and you can put in Sir Roderick that we didn't talk about, but also comes in this pack. You get more ladies with Arya and Sansa to trigger Lady Sansa's Rose, and then pretty much all of the knights from Tyrell are non-loyal. So you can just port all of that right in, and that's the deck I'm going to build.
And I'm actually going to be building a Greyjoy Rose for melee, because we're going to be playing a fair bit of melee, and I think Greyjoy Rose is the way to go right now with all the knights. With the plot diversity, you can pack both plots in there if you get enough knights. I think it'll be unstoppable.
So no one's going to build Night's Watch? They get such a cool character in this, and there's no Night Watch?
They do get a really cool character.
Joe from Cincinnati will build Night's Watch. We can trust Joe to build Night's Watch.
Joe?
He'll build enough decks for all of us.
We're looking at you for that to happen. And if you want to come and build it on the show with us, you can contact Alex.
Splendid. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for that, John. And thank you both of you, Sean and Evan, for joining us.
Yep. Thanks, guys.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So I have a tip of the week. I played a whole two games with my current deck for the tournament coming. The reason that this happened was because at first, when I decided I was going to play Greyjoy, I kind of got obsessed with the idea of playing Fealty. And I played a bunch of games with it, and it did pretty good. But I kind of refused to listen to a bunch of people's advice to, you know, it's better with a banner. And because I kind of became married to my deck, which is like, I just liked it so much that I didn't want to look at other options. And becoming married to a person is a good idea. Becoming married to a deck is a bad one.
Is Tara standing right behind you?
No. So, you know, you have to make sure that if everyone's telling you something or suggesting something, you should try it. You need to be able to break out from that and go, okay, in fact, I've seen this phenomenon in the past. So that's what I suggest to people, that when you're testing for a tournament, don't be afraid to change that deck.
I am extremely surprised that you bring up this tip without mentioning your blog in which you talked about deck marriage.
I got made fun of too much by Alex for that, so I'm just going to stay quiet.
Deck marriage is a concept. Everybody falls into it. I started off Game of Thrones, and I loved the idea of this Greyjoy Night's Watch deck in the first edition, where Night's Watch wasn't a thing for a good reason. And I built the best possible Greyjoy Night's Watch deck.
It was really good for a Greyjoy Night's Watch deck, exactly. Which made it about tier 3.
Yeah, yeah. And I think everybody does that to some extent. You get a pet deck, and then you drive it to the point where it's so good, or it's as good as it's going to get. And I think you need to realize that, and then, you know, you can revisit it in a few more years, you know, when more cards have come out, but you should not...
Cut your losses.
Yeah, exactly. There's a point where you have to cut your losses if you're going to be, you know, it's not that you have to play the best deck in the field, but it's that you need to recognize when you're playing a deck simply because it's that deck you like and not because you've tried other things and dislike them. So after last week's episode where Nate reconfirmed that Valor was coming back to the game, there were many, many posts claiming the sky was falling, many, many derisive posts claiming that there were second edition players didn't know what they were talking about and that Valor coming back would be fine. And so we kind of wanted to talk about that, and to do that we brought on Buzz Andres Aldrin from Sweden, who we last had on the show after his excellent showing at Worlds in one of our last episodes of Season 2. So, how are you today, Buzz?
I'm very well. Been packing all day.
Oh, not necessarily all day, because when I asked you to do this, you asked for a few pointers. I said, yeah, but it'll be a short little 10-minute segment. And then you said, well, I've only written 2.5 pages so far. So,
yeah.
Uh-oh.
So maybe we should start off. Does anyone happen to remember what the card effects of the plot Valor in first edition happened to be?
Is there anyone who doesn't?
I know Jakob might not know. I don't think he ever played it.
Jakob, that's right. This was a plot. So it's one of your 7 plots. It was a limited one per deck back when that basically didn't matter, but it was a reprint from the CCG where occasionally it did. And it was a 2 gold, 0 initiative, 0 claim plot. Reserve didn't exist in first edition, and it said, when revealed, kill all characters. It didn't say cannot be saved. You could still save characters. But it was released in the core of the LCG, and it was a major force for most of the game. I would go so far as to say that a lot of people claim it was everywhere, and I sort of want to start on that. Would you guys agree with that?
Kind of. I understand what people say if they say it's everywhere, because it was in the majority of decks, but there were a lot of decks that didn't run it.
Yeah, I'd probably say it was probably in 80% of decks, and I guess you can qualify 80% as everywhere if you really wanted.
I think people who say, yeah, even the 80% of decks, I've heard people, even on another cast, say that, you know, at Worlds or at Gen Con, it was an all but one deck, which is absurd, because there were rush decks that didn't want to run it, there were aggro decks that didn't want to run it, especially in certain periods of the game, and decks with other resets later in the game didn't want to run it either. The deck that took me first to Swiss at Worlds and earned me my overall was not running Valor, so there certainly were a lot of decks that weren't. But I think in every game, you expected a Valor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
You had to be playing all the time as if your opponent or you were going to wind up Valoring the board at some point within that.
Yeah. And it really taught players, especially new ones, not to overextend, not to just keep playing characters if they're already ahead in board position, if they're already winning, because that could be a trap that would be very easily exploited by a single plot. And I think that had a big impact on the game.
Now, there is an aspect from the sort of Magic players that are going to say, what, this is an on-demand, like you don't have to really pay for it, and you don't have to draw into the card, and it's a board reset. And then there's the other people who say, well, yeah, but it's in your plot deck, which means you're going to be forced to play it if you hit that 7th plot, and therefore it can backfire, unlike a card you drew. Where do you guys stand on that?
For me, the you know, you don't have to pay for it seems a little off. Like you said, it's one of my seven plots, so that's taking a plot spot. I'm paying for it. Its stats in first edition were horrible. I assume that they're going to be equally, maybe more horrible in second edition. Like if you were to generically reprint Valor exactly as it was, 200
with zero reserve,
or with some reserve, say a 6, because that's like the average. The plot would be worse in second edition than it was in first because of the way gold is done. Because of the larger gold curve, it would actually make Valor a worse plot than it was before. It still probably fit into a bunch of decks, but I don't think as high as 80% anymore.
Oh, not at all.
If that was the case. But who knows what they're going to do with it, right? Like, the idea of Valor coming back could be completely different.
The question then being, was this card necessary for first edition? Because I came out of first edition convinced the card was necessary, and I've been learning about it more from not having it here in second edition. So looking back, do I still think, or do you guys still think, it was a necessary part of first edition?
Oh yeah, yeah, really. If you just look at draft, for example, the draft formats, it really destroyed some of the cards. I mean, there were a lot of cards that were good because of Valor or was bad because of Valor, and then was extra good in draft because Valor was not really prevalent and stuff like that. Also, some factions like Martell or Lannister, who often play tempo decks or control, they really needed Valor because of how they were designed to begin with. I mean, several other smaller reasons is it reduces the impact of variance due to bad draws. It could be a comeback mechanic. I guess we'll get to that later. It gave a toy to the control decks that Martell and Lancer did play often. And also it was a pretty fun card because of the big effects and the big drawbacks, and like something big happened when you played it, and it really affected how you played the game.
It certainly was often a defining moment on the game.
Yeah.
Like if you got it right, then you either maybe stabilized a situation that otherwise would have sucked, and if you got it wrong, you lost the game.
Was it necessary? I think it was necessary in some ways because of the way the cost curve was built, because of the fact that there was so much non-limited economy. And you could just, if there wasn't a Valor, the boards would just get choked huge and scary, and people could basically just flood everything with no threat of retribution.
Now, do you think that's still the case with the other resets that we saw later on, where we had First Snow Winter, where we had Aftermath, where we had, you know, was Valor as necessary then?
No.
No. No, I think Aftermath went a long way, but stuff like the Pale Mare I didn't think was enough. Wildfire was probably not enough. I think Aftermath was enough, though.
Yeah, there was a lot of decks in the end cut Valor altogether and just run Aftermath instead. If it's a kind of an aggro deck, but not really. So a lot of Targ decks, I think, in Sweden ran Aftermath purely and nothing else.
I certainly did. Well, and sometimes Threat from the North.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which could also serve the purpose of a Valor, yeah.
Yeah.
There are some other aspects that I think we didn't necessarily touch on why it might have been necessary. I think partly this is different because of Reserve, but the entry challenges in First Edition and the accumulation of a hand. Basically, if you could just spit out your entire hand on the board, then entry challenges become almost meaningless. And where you have to keep cards in hand, good cards in hand, to recover from the Valor, entry gained a lot of weight and was probably the most important challenge in first edition.
Yeah.
Another aspect that I think is rather important is what it did to saves. And you might think in knowing second edition that dupes became way more common, but it's actually the opposite, because the chances of your character dying rather than getting discarded due to Varus or something were much higher. So saves were good, but saves that weren't dupes, basically.
Yeah. Because they wouldn't be a dead card, unlike a dupe, that if that character had died to Valor, would be a dead card. And do you think we're going to see some more of that? Valor enters the environment?
I think we already have, actually. I think that this may be one of the reasons, and I think there are several, that Valor was not in the core box, is giving the time to introduce these cards, because we're seeing the Eerie. which is a reaction to the phase starting and stops characters from dying. We've seen Bodyguard in the core, but we're seeing Blood Magic Ritual. We're seeing the last plot of this cycle is the one that lets you pull a character out of your dead pile into the discard, if the Czech translation is correct. So I think that these elements that are going to help deal with Valor are being seeded into the card pool before Valor comes.
Yeah.
I think that's really smart design.
Yeah, I think we're going to see several resets cards, or at least one more, after the first Snow Winter, of course, that's coming soon. I think we will see something like Threat from the North, or maybe Aftermath, or something similar, before we see Valor. And yes, the new players gets to play with a new reset every few months or something, and then we get to see Valor finally, and then they realize easily that it's not that big of a deal.
Now, you mentioned that we would probably talk about this later, but there are people who feel that the current game is a little too snowball-y and that Valor is a comeback card. I don't really agree with that, but I'm curious as to your thoughts before I start my tirade.
Yeah, I understand how you could see this as a comeback card. Maybe it is, but I really don't see it that way. It's just one tool that you have at your disposal that you need to utilize effectively. I mean, in the deck building process, when many good players build their plot decks first, and then they build a deck to complement the plot at least, but that was certainly the case for many good players in the first edition. So you go into the game and you already have a plan before the game starts. I'm going to play Valor on this specific turn, or if this specific scenario arises. So the biggest indicator of a good player, I think, in first edition was, how do you play around Valor? When do you play Valor yourself?
Yeah, I have to agree. I don't think it was a comeback card. I think it definitely had the perception of a comeback card, because the player that had the superior character base felt like they were in charge. But that's not necessarily always the case. You have to look at total card advantage, right? And Valor allowed you to seize a lot of card advantage, because you could be killing, you know, five of your opponent's characters for one of your own, giving you this huge four-card swing. And if all of their cards were on the board and not in their hand, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're winning. And you could see that. Like, the best example was Bloodthirst, where their board state was extremely small, and they were all about those events and things in their hand. And I think Valor really, like you were saying, Alex, incensed aside the intrigue challenge to pull out those cards that they couldn't recover as easily. And I think people misconstrued someone that was actually probably at least doing as well as their opponent, but had a lesser board state, as someone that was behind and then coming back thanks to Valor.
Mm-hmm. I think I was expecting us to agree on this, because we have all played at that higher level where your opponent is playing around the Valor at all times, and you are as well. You know, there are some cases where the Valor is the exact opposite of a comeback card. In a Greyjoy deck where you have a bunch of saves and you play that aggressively, that's not a comeback card. That's a card to lock down a game. But in the other situations, I really do feel like it's a way to leverage advantages of your deck. You have a whole bunch of cards in hand and a good economy base, and his economy base is shaky. Maybe now's the time to play Valor, because his recovery will be poor. But it's not, you're not getting back into the game. You're just taking the things that are best about your current position and using those to their greatest advantage.
On the other hand, it could be a comeback card in certain decks, because in a Rush deck, for example, he won't play seven plots. Either he wins earlier or he loses. And if he sets as a really bad disadvantage early, he might have Valor in his plot deck for that reason and try to come back and have it as a comeback card specifically in that deck.
Yeah, in those situations that I feel, and I may be wrong, that generally turns an impossible situation into a highly improbable situation.
Yeah. It's still a difficult climb kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Now, there's a concern in the second edition players that because first edition had these low curves, these low cost curves, and because Valor was a part of not investing too much in any given character, that if Valor comes back, we're going to drive our curves straight back down. Thoughts?
I think it might have been one of the factors to drive down curves a little bit in first edition, but I don't really see it that way. Valor could be seen as punishing too many big low tempo impactful characters, but I think what's the biggest indicator of a metagame with a lot of shuds, you know, effective small guys, is where aggro was really prevalent, when there was a lot of two claim or rush decks where you needed shuds to either.
Yeah.
You needed bodies either to soak up military or to not give the rush decks unopposed power. And so in a control meta where there's a lot of resets, you'd rather have big impact characters with renown that forces the control player to use his resets, to use his valor. And Baratheon Knights, for example, the Euro Knights, is a great example of a deck that you could bring if you expected certain control decks, because it just gives so much pressure on the opponent with these pretty high-cost, impactful characters, and didn't really care about the Valor.
Now, I have to ask a completely tangential question, but is someone assembling IKEA furniture behind you, Andreas?
Oh yeah, I think they're actually doing something upstairs, like remodeling somehow. I'm not sure.
I'm going to pretend that in the basement there's a Swedish chef, and upstairs someone's assembling IKEA furniture.
Yes, of course.
Of course.
Why not?
I have to, again, I'm going to agree with you. Wow, we're just going to keep going around agreeing.
this is good radio.
I think that these powerful characters will be Valor Sinks, so they'll see a Daenerys or something, and then they'll want to blow her up immediately, so they might have to Valor to get rid of her. But as long as you have other impactful characters, what I think you're going to see is you might see less dupes, as we had talked about before. You might see other seven cost characters being played in a mix in a deck, giving a little bit more variety to these decks, which can be good and bad, right? Because now they're losing their consistency, so some people might still, like most people, still probably run three Daenerys in a Dany deck. But you might see some other houses start to run multiples of different seven cost characters in order to get around that. But they're not going away, because if you think about the cards that have the most impact on the board state and do the most for you, it is these higher cost cards right now. And as long as that continues to be the case, that we don't get to a point where smaller, cheaper characters can do similar things, people are still going to want to play them, because when they hit the table, they can win you games.
I think it's hard to predict how this will shake out, but it's also worth noting that in a game that will be driven towards a little more card advantage with Valor, losing the 7-coster to Valor is less painful, or can be less painful, than losing 2 to 3 other cards to a similar cost. I think it's also worth noting that if you double down on a big character and you do get the dupes, or you do get alternate save methods, if your Dany survives that Valor, you are probably against an empty board with a character that is completely capable of dominating it. So I'm not convinced that Valor will drastically drop the curve. It does mean that you can get punished for having invested too much in any given character. And I mean, if you flip Noble Cause and he flips Valor, then you marshal a 7-coster and they don't have claim to kill it, chances are pretty good you're getting a very safe turn with that character, even if it's getting punished next turn. Yeah. But then you control two of their plots for the turn. Like, that's also a big advantage that you gain from that.
Yep.
Yeah, they run into that naval superiority of yours too, and then that's it. No gold for them. Two rounds in a row.
Then, I mean, we've talked about first edition, that it probably was necessary for the game, and that it's had these effects on the game. Does second edition need a Valor? Either did it need one in the core, does it need one right now, or will it need one in the future?
I don't think I needed it in the core. It's a good game we're playing, right? I'm one of the strong believers in that there's too much snowball effects going around, and games are decided pretty early in a pretty early plot. But I think Nate had a really he knew he was gonna release Valor from the beginning, and he's creating an environment That's not what I wanted to say. Whatever.
Creating an environment where it will be necessary?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, that's fine.
I mean, he is creating these plots like the one who grabs from the dead pile. He is introducing First Snow, which is one reset, and we already have two others. And I think it will create a healthier meta with a bigger variety of decks because control will get a place, which we don't really see at the moment.
John?
I don't think it needs it at all. I mean, the game, like everyone says, is great. It's fun. We have Varus for those decks, those control decks that want to wipe the board. You know, we've had a very successful Night's Watch version of a board wiping deck that has won some tournaments. But the question is, just because you don't need something doesn't mean it shouldn't come into the card pool. So all these two...
These
players are always saying, oh, we don't need it. I totally agree with you. We don't need it. I mean, I don't need cake and ice cream either, but...
We want it.
Yeah, is it nice to have sometimes? Yeah, it is.
I like your answer better. Scrap what I said.
All right. So I really like John's answer, so I'm going to go with that. This saves me the bother of having to think of my own. But there is something that we're touching on how even if the core didn't need it, and that we're seeding cards that will make it work better in the environment and not be as shocking as it was in first edition, especially in a small card pool, where, for instance, if it was core only, everybody's playing 3x unique. So as soon as one of them is dead, then you have two dead draws in your card, and that feels disproportionately impactful. But just by virtue of the card pool growing, you're going to be running more one-ofs, you're going to have more options for your deck, and you're not forced to. You still can run 3 Danny, but you're no longer forced to just to make a legal deck. And I think that's a large portion of why we can add Valor down the road. And I think the other thing is that people are pretty happy with the number of rounds that a game takes right now. You know, you generally win in 4 to 7 or something like that. And as you add more cards, you build in synergies by themselves. Renowned decks get more rushy. Control decks get more controlly just by virtue of having more pieces, right? And so generally, the game speeds up. The decks are more efficient. And Valor is actually a way to slow decks down a little, not just because it kills characters, but because you don't overextend as much, knowing that you might get Valored. So I think the game needs to pick up the pace a little bit before you can introduce Valor to slow it back down to the 5 to 7 plot range that we're pretty happy with right now.
I really wish I was as good as you guys at analyzing this game.
Well, I really wish I was as good at you at playing this game. So.
Oh.
I'll take the analyzing of Alex and your ability to play Buzz, and I'll be good.
So I guess the final question is, when do you want to see Valor?
I don't think we need it like in the next chapter packs, and I don't think we will see it in even a year. More likely in a year and a half.
I'd like to see it after a couple box sets. Kind of what you were talking to earlier, Alex, and how the game will start to accelerate as we introduce more cards. And those box sets will be introducing a lot of new cards. So if we see 2 or 3 of these box sets, we're going to get this like jump. And we're going to be suddenly at a place, instead of waiting for cycles, we're suddenly going to be at a place where the card pool is way more robust. There won't be a need to run the duplicates so that the impact of Valor won't be felt as strongly. And I think that would be the perfect time to introduce it. So I'm going to say, if they can bring it in after 2 or 3 of these box sets, I think that's the perfect time.
I think it is a question of letting the game speed up a little bit more and giving a little more depth to it. So I would not like to see it in this cycle or in the Stark box that seems to be coming up very soon. But if it's in the next cycle, near the end of the next cycle, maybe I'd be okay with it. Early on, might
like the last chapter pack.
Early. Yeah. Well, Nate did say
that's what I heard when the big impact.
Yeah, Nate did say on our interview that he likes the big impact cards to be early or late in the cycle to sort of give that feeling of opening this brand new meta in a pack. So maybe that would be the earliest I would like to see it is at the end of the next cycle. All right, closing comments. I have nothing to mention except that I'm very excited about our 100th episode next week.
And John Bruno's cool, and he knows why.
But I don't know why. I like to know why.
You don't know why John Bruno's cool?
I know reasons why John Bruno's cool. I don't know the reason John Bruno's cool.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.